Palmer, and I'm the new associate pastor here at Holden. And like many of you, I just came from Minnesota. And this morning we're going to be looking at another passage from Luke 10, verses 25 to 37. And we'll start right off by someone reading it.
Saying, "Teacher, what shall I do to inherit eternal life?" He said to him, "What is written in the law? How do you read?" And he answered, "You shall love the Lord your God with all your heart, and with all your soul, and with all your strength, and with all your mind, and your neighbor as yourself." And he said to him, "You have answered right. Do this, and you will live." But he, desiring to justify himself, said to Jesus, "And who is my neighbor?" And Jesus replied, "A man was going down from Jerusalem to Jericho, and he fell among robbers, who stripped him and beat him and departed, leaving him half dead. Now by chance a priest was going down the road, and when he saw him, he passed by on the other side. So likewise, a Levite, when he came to the place and saw him, passed by on the other side. But a Samaritan, as he journeyed, came to where he was. And when he saw him, he had compassion. And he went to him and bound up his wounds, pouring on oil and wine. Then he set him on his own beast and brought him to the inn and took care of him. And the next day he took out 2 denarii and gave them to the innkeeper, saying, 'Take care of him, and whatever more you spend, I will repay you when I come back.' Which of these 3 do you think proved neighbor to the man who fell among robbers?" And he said, "The one who showed mercy on him." And Jesus said to him, "Go and do likewise."
Perhaps this is one of the most familiar parables in the Bible. And like our text of yesterday, the Magnificat, it's something that we've heard a lot and no doubt have lots of associations with this story already. So let's begin with that. What are some of your associations, connections, thoughts, reactions to this story? Or what have your reactions and associations been in the past?
Well, I feel like these are our neighbors here, you know, in Christ. We can love each other and be neighborly in a sense that it definitely didn't exactly mean it has to be next door to you or on either side or something that you see every day or whatever. It's, you know, in Christ. And I always feel like you're all my friends.
I think of the priest and the Levite, the people who we thought would, you know, have compassion and give assistance, but they didn't do it. They passed by.
Are we doing the same thing today with the homeless? I work with a volunteer group in Eugene, Oregon, at the group called FISH, and we have people come to us that can't get help from regular situations, like, you know, you have to wait 10 days or and people are sleeping in their cars with no food, and we get no government assistance because we don't have enough bookkeepers and things. And so I think that this is the situation that we have in Eugene, is people without homes who are living in cars, and what are we going to do about it? I mean, do other people have the same situation in your town, people who don't have a place to live and they're looking for work, and or they have to leave their apartments because they're turning off the water and the lights and everything's going up? I mean, I think it's a real situation that it's just like this. I mean, we can do it individually.
Yeah, I love
that. We all like to think of ourselves as a good Samaritan. Mm-hmm. We don't like to put ourselves in the other person's feelings.
I'm always reminded of this whenever I pass somebody on the road who's having difficulty and don't stop. You know, I'm on my way to do the Lord's work somewhere, a program or a service or something, and you know, too busy to stop and help.
I think of the same thing I was going to mention. You know, going on, somebody's hitchhiking, and this day and age, can a person jeopardize himself or his family? And maybe a person don't have enough faith that the Lord will take care of him, but this day and age is something different, you know. And I feel bad when I pass somebody, but I don't know. I have picked them up. I live in Clarkston, and I worked in Kennewick, and I picked several of them up. Or, well, some kids were bicycling. I had a van, and bicycling, they had a flat tire, so I picked up three of them, and then sometimes the last one I picked up, I don't know that I didn't think that I have to take that guy all the way, but I had to take him 140 miles, and I never smelled anything like that. I don't know if it was dope or what it was, but boy, I got stuck to take him all the way, and I thought, boy, I don't think I want to pick anybody else up again. He said he was going to go be a cook somewhere, and boy, I thought he was. But it is jeopardizing your family. What should a person do? Should a person, is it a lack of faith in the Lord that this man or person, you know, is clean, we might say clean, or who knows? There's so much of it nowadays, and then of course you see a bunch of these dumb TV programs, or don't see a bunch of them where somebody's laying on the side of the car, and then as soon as somebody comes to help them, then they have a gun, you know, or somebody's a bunch of junk. It is something to think about.
It is the same as in the story you just read, because they didn't stop too because they were afraid.
Well, the priest, he didn't stop because he had polluted himself, see, and he was on his way to church. So he wouldn't want to do that, you know. He kept right on and going. I don't know about Levi, but I think it was the same thing for him.
Yeah, they were both in the temple service.
They're both in the same boat.
Sure, there was a physical risk as well, because if that was a place frequented by robbers, it could have been a setup. Somebody could have you could have two Confederates where one pretends to be hurt, but while someone goes to help him, all his friends come out and rob the person that wanted to help him. I mean, I'm sure this is a dangerous world we live in, but I'm sure it was dangerous in those days too. You have to remember that human nature doesn't really change.
Robert McAfee Brown, who is the author of this book we mentioned yesterday, Unexpected News, Reading the Bible with Third World Eyes, which is in the bookstore, suggests that this story, like the Magnificat, may be too familiar to us. So familiar that we don't notice some things. As we look at the story, it starts with the lawyer asking the question, what do I have to do to earn eternal life? Jesus answers the question and says, so go and do it. Go love your neighbor. But
the lawyer wants to kind of distance himself from that going and doing. So he comes back with a question that's sort of abstract and intellectual. Well, who is my neighbor? So that shifts it from going and being the neighbor to, well, who is the neighbor? Let's talk about a definition. Let's not talk about me being a neighbor. And so that's one move, this kind of distancing. Another thing to look at here is this business of the Good Samaritan. First of all, who is a Samaritan? I want to just read a definition of that. The Samaritans, descendants of Gentile settlers and Israelites, had been a thorn in the side of the Jews for centuries. In Jewish eyes, they were racially half-breeds and religiously apostates. They were publicly cursed in the synagogues and made the object of a daily prayer that they might not enter eternal life. Their center of worship in Samaria was a countertype and rival to the temple in Jerusalem. Therefore, Galilean pilgrims crossing Samaria on their way to Jerusalem were subjected to harassment and sometimes to overt violence. The title of the story, The Good Samaritan, is really a linking of terms that wouldn't be normally put together. What would be something similar for us in our own day, such an unlikely pairing, to get the irony across in this story, The Good Samaritan?
The motorcycle gang, maybe?
The good motorcycle gang member?
The good black?
The good black?
I suppose any small ethnic group within your larger community.
Mm-hmm.
The good hippie?
The good hippie? Mm-hmm.
What, the good Libyan or the good Iranian?
So we've got this question going on. I want to read just a little excerpt from Brown where he makes kind of a witty laying out of what was going on with this lawyer and asking these questions. Let us explore the lawyer's inner reflections. Should the discussion prove fruitful, this discussion of who is my neighbor, perhaps a symposium can be organized around a theme like the concept of neighborliness, and a really comprehensive definition arrived at. The lawyer, in fact, sits on the board of a small foundation that might be persuaded to finance such a project. There could be a series of papers. The Stoic concept of neighborliness. Neighborliness in recent Mideast fiction, a very short paper. The cultural implications of neighborliness for improving trade relations with Greece. Neighborliness, a woman's perspective, written by a man in order to maintain the desired objectivity. And finally, tapping the local PhD thesis market, there could be a paper titled Neighborliness as Seen by Members of the Slave Class, being a series of interviews conducted in the Alexandrian slave market for the purpose of attaining contemporary data on satisfaction-dissatisfaction ratios. The papers, the lawyer continues to reflect, could then be published, perhaps edited by the lawyer himself, and the contributors could add the volume to their list of publications as a way of assuring that they get academic tenure rather than their neighbors. But Jesus comes back with an answer to the question, who is my neighbor? This lawyer's attempt to distance this question with this story. And with the story, we get the answer that who is the neighbor?
Anybody.
The person in need. Mm-hmm. It's interesting that Jesus never identifies the person who's found on the side of the road. It's that person's identity is kept as vague as possible. What would be for us, in our experience, the person who has no identity, the person who is closest in our society to having no identity?
Mm-hmm.
The homeless?
Straight person, the homeless.
Unemployed.
A runaway.
Unemployed, runaway. Brown, in drawing on his reflections about the two-thirds world, suggests the undocumented worker, the person who has no social security number, no papers. And then Brown draws for us the perspectives of a few liberation theologians in looking at this passage. Gustavo Gutierrez suggests that the neighbor is not just the one we find along our way. When Jesus answers, "Who is my neighbor?" he asks at the end of the story, "Which of these proved neighbor?" So he takes the question from an abstract and kind of definitional question, answering it in terms of action. Who proved neighbor? Who acted as neighbor? And it's not just the hurting person who is the neighbor, but the person, the Samaritan, who enacts the business of neighborliness. And again, I want to read, as we did yesterday, from the Gospel and Solentiname and their reflections on this text. We're accustomed to thinking that this parable is to make us see that the Samaritan is the one who loved his neighbor. And what Jesus asks at the end of the parable is which of the three who passed by on the road was the neighbor of the wounded man. One answered, "The man without religion was the neighbor." It wasn't the wounded man, an earlier impression dying hard. It wasn't the wounded man. Felipe said, "It seems that instead it's the one who serves that is the neighbor." So the shift from, is the neighbor the one there on the road, or is the neighbor the one who serves that one? Gutierrez put it this way, "The neighbor was the Samaritan who approached the wounded man and made him his neighbor." And 2 points in that definition of Gutierrez. The neighbor was the one who approaches, the person who enters into the wounded man's situation. And it's not just any person along the road, but it's a person who suffered injustice and violence. And we have in the story the word compassion, which means literally, when we split apart, the prefix com and passion is to suffer with, coming with. Gutierrez says another way to define compassion is because his heart was melting. And Miranda, another liberation theologian, calls it interhuman justice. So it's the person who approaches the neighbor, and then the second part of that, Gutierrez's definition is, and made him his neighbor. Gutierrez says, "The neighbor is not the one whom I find in my path, but rather the one in whose path I place myself, the one whom I approach and actively seek." And here's the shift that is reflected in the title for this morning that we borrowed from the book, from head trips to foot trips. Not simply the intellectual question of finding who is my neighbor, but it's the business of going and actively seeking out that one to make them my neighbor. I'm going to just repeat that last part of Gutierrez's definition. The neighbor is not the one whom I find in my path, but rather the one in whose path I place myself, the one whom I approach and actively seek. So you see that shift in the story? Who is my neighbor? We expect it to be, you know, which person lying on the road is my neighbor? And the answer comes back, it's the Samaritan.
It never really answers the question, does it? I mean, the question is, who is my neighbor? And the answer is, this is how you go out and be someone's
neighbor. Right, shifted from status of beingness to status of
We are neighbor when we act as neighbor.
Isn't it true, though, that the, that's just one side of the coin, the other side of the coin is the man who fell on the feet. He is a neighbor. The one who's in need and the one who has the wherewithal to meet that need. Both are neighbors.
But I think the key is that we make that one neighbor by what we do, that...
Yeah, well, I think the contrasting point here is that the Jew, who we assume he's a Jew anyway, he fell among the thieves. If he had not fallen among the thieves, would be disposed to spit in the face of the Samaritan. If he were well and healthy, he would disdain even contact with the Samaritan. But there he was, without any defense whatsoever, and the Samaritan answered his need, whereas the old fellow Jews passed him by, simply because they were afraid of besmirching themselves. Maybe the guy was dead, and they'd take him 3 days or so to get purified so they could go back to their service. So I see both of them as neighbors.
But the key, is there a distinction there as the key being it's the action?
The Samaritan could not have been neighbor if he went over there and patted the guy on the head, said, "That's too bad, be comforted by the Lord," and then passed on without doing a pleasant thing. You know, it's like Peanuts cartoon. You've seen that one. Snoopy is freezing to death, and they come along all bundled up nice and warm, pat him on the head, "Be warm and be filled," and then they walk off and don't do anything about it, and he's still there in the ice and the snow.
And the question of Jesus at the end is, which of these proved neighbor? That's an action question.
Maybe he never answers the question, "Who is my neighbor?" because it's supposed, maybe the answer is there is no one person, there's no group of people, it is everyone. And maybe that question is just understood after the whole context of the story.
And especially at the time of need, not to go past.
It sounds like the lawyer was trying to narrow it down to maybe one specific group of people or one specific situation so that he wouldn't have to put himself out too much. And he found out that he couldn't do that.
Yeah. The lawyer, like us, was probably looking for some boundaries. These folks are our neighbors. Well, these folks you don't have to worry about. And it got turned all around to point at us. What are you doing? Which one proved neighbor? How are you proving to be a neighbor? Not the question to who. What I'd like to do now is ask you to just slightly turn your chairs around to the people near you, however small a group that is, and to together think about how you would retell this story in terms that bring it as close to your experience as possible. That means there probably isn't going to be someone in the story who's a Samaritan. That's not in your experience. But retell the story in a way that brings it as close, makes it as immediate to your experience as possible. And it's not the whole text, but just the story about the road, that part of the story. And then we'll share some of those stories with each other. So now you are going about the business of helping us bring this text closer to us.
Well, and the reason that we told the story is that they experienced the same thing in a different part of the country, but virtually the same note.
Yeah.
Different car. Red station wagon. Yours was
a green station wagon with a trailer, but
And that's a true story, and that's 1988 version.
Of course, the thing that the people should have done was to have referred them to the first agency who would take them in, because the agency say that we're not supposed to do this type of thing because there's an agency to take care of every need, even the fellow that meets you on the street who's pumping everybody for, used to be 10 cents, now it's a dollar, you know, that you tell him which agency to go to.
We tried to do that, and they said they had been to churches and so forth, and that they, with the economic situation as it is, that the churches were only helping their own, that they refused to help them.
Not true, though.
It's not true.
Every church in my town has a cupboard or something and will do something, even if it's just a bag of groceries. You know, I'm just trying to give you a bad time.
Oh, be my guest.
We have a cupboard at our church also. But we were not near home. We couldn't send them to the church that we go to. And we weren't familiar with the area we were in, with what was available.
Another story. My people shared many interesting stories about things along the road, but they asked me to be the spokesman. And my story was concerning a nursing home in our town. I'm the nursing home board, and I do much volunteer work there. And I guess my story was that sometimes we fail to be good Samaritans. A young man was brought into the home about a year ago with cerebral palsy. He was in his early 20s. His parents were both dead, and an aunt in our town had seen that he came into our nursing home. This boy could only do guttural sounds. He lay prone in a reclining chair. He had no control over any of his bodily functions. But he would reach out when you came in with his hand, and he would smile. He could smile. And for a time, when we saw people come in, they seemed to avoid him. But you couldn't help seeing him, because of that smile and that outstretched arm. And to some, he was repulsive. But each day I came, I could not help but to notice this young man. And I became attracted to his smile. And I got to a point where I could take hold of his hand. And now I tried to converse with him each time I came in. But I guess it takes time sometimes to do this.
Yeah. Well, somebody told me to tell my story and say it's a true story. It means that we're using true stories. But anyway, wife and I, we went to a town about 40 miles from where we live, and they got King's Table. I don't know if you know what that kind of place is or not. You know, they got salads and everything. They were just changing over from lunch to dinner, dinner to lunch. It's always breakfast, dinner, and supper to me, as far as I'm concerned, always with me. But anyway, this man come up there and was looking. I was looking at the list, see when it was open up and see how much the prices were. And this man come up there, I think he had two these plastic bags loaded. And I think he had about three trench coats on, and he had a beard. You couldn't tell how old he was. I think he might have been around 35. And he looked at me and talked a little bit, and he said, "Will you buy me a meal?" If he'd asked me for money, I don't think I'd have given him any. But I didn't smell any wine or anything on him. And I said, "You ain't got any money?" "No, not a." And he said he didn't have any. And I said, "Meals cost quite a bit here." And I thought maybe I'd just give him enough money to buy his meal and use what he had. But then it changed my mind. We went inside there, and after it opened up, and I put the two plastic bags over by a booth, you know, and I thought, boy, I'd take him through this line here, and he's got all these coats on, reaching over and stuff like that, so I took the plates, and we went down the line, and I was about first in line, and I said, "You like that?" "Oh, yeah, you like that?" And I really loaded him up, you know, and give him a big meal and set him down, And the part that I didn't like about it is I was too prejudiced and we didn't sit down with him. And he was probably just itching to talk to somebody. And I felt bad ever since and still do to this day that I, and later on I gave him an extra $5 bill. I said, you might not be so lucky in the next town you come to. And after he ate, why, he come over and thanked me. And well, in a way, I didn't want to polish my halo, but to just put rust right back on again because I was too prejudiced to talk to him.
Other stories.
Yeah, this one occurred in another country, I understand, but a Pentecostal group were traveling along. They had a flat tire. They had no apparel to change that tire. No instruments or tools. And so they several vehicles passed them by before finally a couple of soldiers came by and not only provided the tools but changed the tires. And when they got through, they were thanked for it. The only smirch on the whole story was that the two soldiers were obviously drunk, but and probably deserved some criticism. But who could criticize someone who helped that way? That's the story. Perhaps the moral of the story is that you get help from the least likely source.
In our group, we had one telling a story. As softball game was going on, and one of the boys was hurt. But the coach said, well, the game has got to go on anyway, so come on, boys, let's get going. We got to play. We're on schedule. And the boys probably wanted a little bit to help, but seeing the coach said they had to get playing, they went back to playing. And the boy that was hurt was lying there, and an old lady came walking by, and she helped the little boy that was hurt. That was the story that we got.
Any other
questions? We had several good ones. One, our daughter lives in Dobbs Ferry, New York, which is 10 miles out of New York City. The church is there. Have what they call the homeless run. And by the churches, I don't mean you get in that particular area, there's darn few Lutheran churches. But there were a lot of other churches, and as a group, they make their runs into New York City to help the homeless. And the stories that you get back from that, the people that you are helping, and they're taking in sandwiches, they're taking in clothing, and they're taking in blankets. And some one person may be one who tries to be quite selective as to which clothing they get, simply because they do not want to get the appearance of street people, because they are trying very hard to not get the appearance of a street person, because if they do, they cannot get a job. The other extreme is the one who lives in a cardboard refrigerator box, and when they come by, does not open the box, only just far enough to put their hand out and take a sandwich. I think they're being neighbors.
I'm reminded of an incident. This was, I didn't share it with the group because I hadn't thought of it at the time. But when I was in college, this was in the 30s during Depression years, we were standing in line, a long line, at the college cafeteria when suddenly the door opened from the outside and a very bedraggled gentleman walked in. and just a hush came over the whole line because he simply didn't belong. And I remember there was a girl, Doris Dominick from Hopkins, Minnesota, who stepped out of line, went over, took him by the arm, brought him to the head of the line, took him through, filled his tray, and sat down with him and ate him.
Octavia has a good story if she'll share it with us.
Octavia talks all the time and tries to make some else. This was in a rural setting where there was a house that should have been abandoned on a piece of farmland. And one day the neighbor noticed an old truck roll in and some children get out, and there was light in that house that evening. So the neighbor thought, I'll go down in the morning. At 5:30 a.m., was a terrible racket, screaming and crying, and here was the mother and three little girls, 2, 4, and 6, at the neighbor's door, pounding on the door. It was late fall and there was snow on the ground, and the little girls simply had little gingham dresses, no underclothes, no shoes, no socks. And so they were taken in and given breakfast. And during the conversation, it came out that they had moved out from the city. And in this old house was an old wood or coal stove. And the mother didn't know how to keep the fire going. So the family went back with them the next morning after they had clothed the children, and they had boots and mittens and scarves and complete outfits of clothing. Showed the mother how to run this stove, keep the fire going, even went to town and got some coal and brought out. 5:30 the next morning, the same story. Here were the children, barefoot, just in little night clothes, and you take them back, and the clothes were in the corner, and the mother of the children said, well, they're dirty. So outfit the children so that they'll have two outfits so she can wash one while they're wearing the others. This went on for 3 months back and forth at various times. And then the father got work in Nebraska. He called back, asked the farm family if they would take his wife and the children to the train and send them out to this town in Nebraska. Well, of course, the wife had no money. So the little girls had each a sack of groceries and were fully clothed and dressed nicely when they got on the train. And not even a thank you. And the farm family thought about this family often. 12 years later, the mother calls back and she says, this is Sally. I don't think you remember. And the farm wife said, oh, yes, I've been thinking about you. And she said, I knew you would be thinking about us. And I just want to tell you that the girls are all in college. And because you helped, we decided life was worth living. It took 12 years until this family knew, so don't get excited if you try to help, and don't get thanks. The seed is planted and it will grow.
It's easy to have a price tag. We want to thank you for what we do. We didn't give a thank you. Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, that wasn't it, but it was the concern.
Right.
You know, what happened. And I think it does show that deep down, probably they can't express it. Probably they're so embarrassed at having to be in that situation.
Any other stories?
I've got a story, yeah. not related to that, but it, in a way, but at our camp this summer, we had a group of East Germans that came to camp through the efforts of a fellow by the name of Herb Brokery. Several of you probably know him. They professed that they were not Christians. That was one of the foregone conclusions that we had to understand. They didn't want any Christianity shoved down their throat, but we had them at the camp for a number of days. And one of the things that they were appalled at, they said, was that we came to America and we understood that that was the most affluent nation in the world. And he says, in East Germany, we don't have homeless, we don't have starving, we don't have people that don't have jobs. And it's kind of a indictment, I think, against our culture that we look down on the most of us on the communist form of leadership as less than us. And this is the thing that they were appalled about, that that we end up with the poor people, the unemployed, the those with lack of medical attention, and the people that we kind of look down on, have those things. They may pay a high price in other areas, but that's where the rubber hits the road.
Let me just pick up on that for a closing kind of question to send us out thinking about. Brown suggests this exercise, that we imagine that we are in the story of the Good Samaritan, and week after week, we're going down the road and we keep encountering victims of robbery and things, and each time we help them, and finally it occurs to us, this is a stupid way to respond. We keep binding up victims every time we make the trip, but nothing changes. Binding up wounds isn't enough. We've got to ensure that people don't need to be bound up in the first place. So then, in this story, we make some phone calls to some legislators, and we make some laws that make that area safer, restricted, there's less crime going on there. And then he says, such measures may make the road a little safer and virtually eliminate highway robberies and muggings, but the thieves, who are not stupid, will simply transfer their activities to areas more conducive to their personal health and longevity, and there will be a sudden rash of house breakings in suburban Jericho. So then he raises the question of what more radical, that is, getting to the roots, that meaning of the word radical, what more radical steps could be taken? Those who want to meet the problem will have to ask such questions as, why do so many people steal in the first place? Is it because they can't get jobs? Do we provide so little good education for young people that they turn to beating up travelers out of frustration or boredom? Are the thieves facing debts they can't pay off because interest rates are exorbitant? What percentage of the thieves are from minority groups, the last hired and the first fired, who thus have lots of time for moonlighting? Whose job is it to deal with these problems? And I think those questions push us beyond the questions of Band-Aid kinds of help to what? How can we be affecting larger systems so that there isn't that victim on the side of the road for us to simply help them get on to the next day, but how can we affect greater changes? And given the time, that will have to be a question that we think about and discuss with each other in the days ahead. But thank you for sharing your stories.